Guess what? We're starting a new weekly class called A Yoga of Business. And this is for all of you who have sent me emails in the past and of late, asking questions and seeking some advice on the business and production side of things. I've been getting an increased number of those inquiries since the pandemic hit, as a lot of people are scrambling a little bit to figure out how to navigate this new landscape. And, you know, I always try to give some advice in those emails, but whatever advice I'm giving is secondhand, because it's my producer, Josh Citron, who's the person that really did all of this for me. He's the one who helped me develop this platform that I have. And he did that based on his own experience of doing independent music and video production. And so he has agreed to do this weekly class with us, where we're going to completely open it up and be entirely transparent about everything that we're doing. We're going to make it completely open source so that you can see for yourself and figure out how you can make some of the things that we're doing work for you. We are going to talk about succeeding without social media. We're going to talk about creating your art and letting that bring people to you rather than trying to sell people on things. We're going to talk about what it means to own the digital land in which you sit. We're going to talk about sustainability over growth and digital tools and audio video production and best practices there. Most importantly, we're going to talk about a new bliss money balance. That's right, bliss money balance. Because ultimately, it amounts to a radical new way of thinking about what we're doing and how we conduct the business aspect. It's a live weekly class. If you can't make it live, then you can send in questions and watch it on the replay. There's limited space. We're never going to have more than 20 people in there at any one time, so you might want to get in on it early. It's called A Yoga for Business. Go check it out. You can learn more and register at jbrownyoga.com. All right. We're here. I mean, I know that I'm here. And if you're listening to this, then that means that you're there wherever you are. And if that's happening, that could only mean one thing. This is Jay Brown Yoga Talks podcast. My name is Jay Brown. Welcome to you if you're a new person. And what's up to the rest of y'all? How are we doing? I don't know about you, but I can feel the shitstorm coming. Can you feel that? Can you feel the shitstorm that's coming? It's like when they talk about how if you've got like an old football injury and you can feel it in your bones when the storm is on the horizon. Well, I feel that through my whole being. I mean, as if we weren't already depleted enough from this pandemic. This election is just, oh my Lord. And we're going to talk about it next week with Sean Korn. Yep, we're going to talk to Sean Korn next week about the coming election and politics and all that stuff, which is just looming. I think not just for people in America, I think the rest of the world. It's just an existential moment. And we will talk about it next week. In the meantime, I don't know about you, but I've been really needing activities that allow me to go places in my mind that aren't where I started with you today, that aren't on the election and all that stuff, but like poetry and art and music, you know, as a way to counter the onslaught of seemingly scary news. So along those lines, I'm really happy for you to hear today's talk with Amy Weintraub. Amy has a new book out called Temple Dancer, and it's a fiction book. And we're going to talk about that today, but it's a fiction book that speaks some important truths that are utterly relevant to our situation. And I was super happy to have this talk with her because I know Amy from long way back. You'll hear we talk about some history together as well. And I knew her for something completely different. Didn't even know she was a fiction writer. So when I found out that she read this book, which, by the way, my wife is engrossed in right now, I thought it would be great to touch base with her, and I was not wrong about that. So I'm excited that you're going to get to hear that conversation today. Before we do, maybe I'll have a moment to check in a little bit with the regular listeners. I got a couple updates on some stuff. First, we decided to put my youngest daughter into the hybrid learning program instead of the full remote. We talked to the kindergarten teacher, we talked to the principal at the school, and I just think what's happening there is safe. It's as safe as the dance class that we decided she can take on Saturdays. Everybody's taking precautions, and I want her to be in school. I don't like the Zoom meetings. I mean, the teacher is doing her darndest. Shout out to Miss Milburn in Forks, PA. She's a great teacher, and she's really doing her best. And they're making changes, and now they're going to do the break-off groups and have them in smaller groups. And they're really trying to make it work, and I commend them for their efforts. But I want her to have an opportunity to be in the school and interacting with her teacher and fellow students, even if that's distanced and masked. I was worried about that early on, and I'm not as worried about that now. We haven't had any cases in the school for weeks now, and I feel like that's the choice that we're going to make. And I totally respect other people who are choosing not to. Fortunately, we did speak to the other families in our pod, and they're cool with it. So my eldest daughter still gets to see her best friend. And that's the decision that we've made. I think it's going to take another week and a half or so before it all kind of processes and happens. But it's all so crazy. I'm sure many of you out there are still having to navigate these same questions. That's why I'm bringing it up. And there is one other thing. And, you know, I hesitate to share this. And part of me is like, why are you sharing this? Maybe it's not a good idea, but I feel like I want to. I want to be open about what I'm doing because I know a lot of people are grappling with the same questions that I'm grappling with. And what I'm talking about is that last week I did a workshop, an in-person workshop, and I traveled. I traveled from Allentown, Pennsylvania, very small airport in Allentown that I managed to find a ticket out of somehow, miraculously. And I flew to Madison, Wisconsin, by way of Detroit, Michigan. And all of the flights I took were under an hour and a half. One of them was an hour, one of them was an hour and a half. I was in the airport in Detroit for 45 minutes. Everything was well distanced and masked the entire time. The airline only booked to like 40%. And, you know, the group that I met was small, six people in a private home. The majority of those six people were already in a pod together. The other two were in adjacent pods. Everybody was responsible. And you know what? I have to say, it felt fucking fantastic. It was great to come together with people again. And I'm not suggesting that we shouldn't be following all the rules. We did. We followed all the rules. We were very careful. But ultimately, I am here to tell you, I've been saying this for weeks and weeks, that there's something about being in the same room with people, and there absolutely is. It was amazing. Like I really felt like I had my A game with me because it's just been so long. It's been over 7 months, 7-8 months. And I felt really hopeful, honestly. I felt like we will find a way to come together that feels safe and is responsible. So it just felt like the canary, like, okay, this is going to be okay. We're going to get through this. And I needed that feeling. So I don't know. Again, we're all having to navigate this moment and make these choices. I know a lot of centers are starting to do in-person classes in this way, spaced. And, you know, I think if, you know, the local authorities where you live are looking at the numbers and they're feeling like it's okay for us to start to get back together again, eventually I think we do need to do that. And it's all so much. And, you know, there's actually like a little more to tell, but I'll save it for the other side because it kind of bears relevance to the conversation with Amy today. So I'll save the last thing that I was going to talk about for the other side. One last thing real quick. I want to mention that this episode is brought to you in support by podcast premium subscribers like Yuka Tope and Kristen Maskamp. Thank you, Yuka and Kristen, and all the rest of our podcast premium subscribers. Not only will you get full access to the archives of this show, but it's the best way to help support us, to help us keep this going each week. You can find out more about becoming a podcast premium subscriber, as well as find all of my other stuff, my live stream classes and the weekly teacher's class, and the new A Yoga of Business class. All of my stuff can be found at jbrownyoga.com. Okay, like I said, I got a few other things to touch base with you on the other side, but for now, let's go ahead and get into this conversation that I had with Amy Weintraub. Hello?
Hi. Hi, Jay. It's Amy.
Hi, Amy. You got here before I did, but...
Oh, yeah. Well, I was testing my audio because I'm usually doing it with, you know, the video. And I'm zoomed out, so this is a good way to do it.
I'm glad you appreciate that. I've had some people of late who actually, like, they prefer to have the video on, and I like you, have been doing a lot of Zooms, and sometimes mm-hmm. it's nice just voice to voice.
It is. And, you know, I was just talking with friends whom I'm sure you know yesterday. We do a very small Sangha international call, and we're all on Zoom all the time. And there's something intimate about just the voice in the ear. And of course, then there's the, you know, you don't have to worry about the lighting. And I mean, I did even shower for the occasion, believe it or not.
Well, you didn't need to. Well, you know,
I know
what I have taken to doing when someone does want the video on and I don't need to record it. Like sometimes you need to record it for later. And if you need to record it for later, this won't work. Uh-huh. But you can click those little three dots in the upper right corner on Zoom, and there's a thing called turn off self view.
Oh, uh-huh.
But you don't see yourself.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And for me, I realized how much energy I expend either like noticing myself or mm-hmm. trying not to notice myself.
Isn't that interesting? And then you're also thinking about the eye contact. You're looking at the camera and you're not seeing the person you're really communicating with. Or, you know, you're looking at the person and then your eyes look like they're not paying attention. So it's tricky. So I really appreciate this. By the way, I did read your blog, your last blog. Have you been able to secure that loan?
It's so funny you ask that. No, not yet. I mean, it's still not, I'm still waiting to hear from the underwriters. They're backed up there. So I haven't gotten a final word yet.
Well, here's what, I had the same situation happen about 2011 when I was buying up in Rhode Island. And when the banks turned me down, I had a really good, broker who, you know, researched some kind of, what looked like a really podunk little loan business mm-hmm. in
some
Florida.
Like credit, people's credit union or something. You know what the difference is? I learned some things about it this time because what you're describing is exactly the same situation. And you really need someone like that broker you found.
Mm-hmm.
You can
mm-hmm.
navigate it and find a lender who will look at you as a person in your situation.
Yes. Yeah. And hopefully you've done that. So
well, we'll see. We'll see. Yeah. And also I have, again, some other possibilities. I'm not like up against it
as of yet or anything. So there's still time to tell, but you get what the piece was about, because yoga teachers are in a situation where we've talked it out as being this like mainstream profession. And yet when it comes down to doing something very mainstream, like getting a house, you don't actually appear all that mainstream to those lenders, you know?
Yeah. And, you know, the other thing that I really remarked on and really did some deep thinking about was just the thought of yoga is not mainstream. It never really has been. You know, what we see, and I'm as guilty as anyone of this because I was in at the early stages of yoga therapy, but is this whole movement towards the medicalization of yoga and the fix, you know, like here's what yoga can do for you. And the research behind all that has moved yoga into a place of like a treatment modality and sometimes away from the deeper spiritual resonance of what I feel yoga is, which will never be mainstream, you know, that connection to the absolute, the Atman and Brahman are one, you know. And so that's where I took it when you were, you know, it wasn't just about the commercialism of yoga, but also how we have, and I mean, I include me. I mean, Life Force Yoga is about making it accessible and, you know, training mental health professionals in some aspects of mudra and mantra and pranayama that are appropriate in a clinical setting. So it's that aspect of yoga too that I think has taken us away from sometimes in some circles away from what's the truth of yoga. And so when you said yoga will never be mainstream, it was like, yeah, really.
Oh, Amy, I am so glad to be talking to you. I can't tell you. To hear you say that, it's very reaffirming. And you know, there is a real convergence that brings us together. I have to tell you a little bit of like how this came about, because it's interesting and in line with what you're saying in a way, because I get a lot of emails from like PR people and publishers. Because I'm like on list as like a blogger and a podcaster for like, you know, books that are coming out and they're trying to get the authors out there and get the people know about it. And most of the time I don't respond to any of them, like, cause they're just random. Like if I don't have a connection in some way, it just feels like, oh, I'm just bringing random people on. So it always wants to have a thread into my inquiry to make it come alive, I think. And so I got an email from your publisher about your new book. What's it called? Temple Dancer, right? And your name was right at the top. And I was like, wait a second, Amy Weintraub. And I look at the book and it's like, as I understand it, because I haven't had a chance to get one or read it, it's a fiction book that has to do with like a connection between sexuality and spirituality. And I was like, wow, wait a second. Isn't she the yoga for depression lady I knew from the Reading Project back in like 2004 or whatever?
Right.
And that's why I responded to it. And then you just responded to my article the way that you did. So I was like, oh, this is a very good reason for me to be talking to you right now.
Well, I felt the connection when I read that article. And just, you know, looking at some of the videos and your, you know, accessibility for students, you know, making it accessible for all populations. And just like, yeah, this is a good connection. I'm looking forward to speaking with Jay. So that's
very, very cool. Well, you know, I will say not only was it just about the fact that I remember you from then, but what I remember about you, because I don't know much about you. We have a lot of mutual friends, but it's not like we've ever hung out or anything. But I remember back then, like I was at the Breathing Project along with a lot of people, I think like you, because it was sort of a little beacon right at a real upward trajectory of yoga becoming real fitness oriented. Like it was we talked about it. You said it was never mainstream. Well, at that time, everybody was trying to make it mainstream. And it was like, on the upward trajectory. You know, I remember Vogue magazine saying like the hip thing of the year was to have a private yoga instructor. I was like getting calls all the time, you know, and there was a few people who were trying to have practice not be about poses and fitness. And I was inspired by Desika Char, and it was all about like purpose and direction in life. And I was trying to bring that into like these vinyasa classes, you know?
You were there.
And you were there doing yoga for depression, if I remember.
And I think, the funny thing is I have a call with Leslie Kaminoff this afternoon.
Look at that. Convergences. See, that's what I'm talking about.
I know. He's been an old friend for years, but I've not been in touch with him.
Well, the reason why I think it's so intriguing that you were doing yoga for depression at that time. Mm-hmm. And I was just like, over the last few weeks on this show, actually, I had Max Strom on talking about emotional healing. And T.S. Little talking about like liminal spaces. And, you know, I think that at that time, though, nobody was, even myself, no one was going in those directions. But you were already someone who was looking at people's emotions. You have to, in a way, when it's about depression. And I guess I'm wondering about that. Like, how is it that at that early time when everybody else was like, you know, showing what they could do with their bodies to sell more DVDs or whatever. How is it that you were not making it about poses, were making it about dealing with depression? Why did it become about that for you instead of poses?
Yeah. Well, do you want to talk about that live, like on the phone call or?
Yeah, we're going. This is it.
This is it. We're going.
This is the conversation. We're in. I always just say hello and this is the conversation we're having. So we're in it. This is it.
Okay. Well, it's my own history of depression. I came to yoga after years of psychotherapy and medication. And I started yoga in the early 90s and was so passionate about it because it started changing my life. And I talk about this a little bit in Yoga for Depression about how it was driving across the Newport Bridge, where I lived in Rhode Island at the time. And I was listening to Jean Houston, the amazing psychologist, and an audio tape in my car at that time. And she was leading an exercise that invited us to name ourselves. And here I am, my eyes half closed. I wouldn't recommend that. And what bubbled up was abundance. And what I realized after I'd been practicing yoga for maybe 8 or 9 months on a daily basis, and I thought, wait a minute. My psychiatrist told me I was one of those people who would always have empty pockets. And so it's just like, wait a minute. I'm naming myself abundance. What's different? And the only thing different in my life was that daily yoga practice. And I had started by going to Kripalu and just we were on these fluffy pink blankets. We didn't even have yoga mats. And I was just enthralled by the practice. I had been meditating for many years on and off, and it didn't address the deep depression I had. And what it did, what I needed was that pranayama included and the mantra chanting. I needed all of that. And that's what really healed me. And I became a yoga teacher. And I just really became passionate about sharing what had literally saved my life and certainly allowed me to slowly titrate with supervision off my medication. And I remember in 1999, I wrote an article for Yoga Journal that was called Yoga, the Natural Prozac. And it was the first article about yoga and its effectiveness in working with mood states. And after that, I started collaborating with researchers. But before that, I had been depression sat on my shoulders, lived in my heart. And I was a fiction writer. And, I think that sometimes artists feel and writers feel that they need that angst. They need that dark side to mine for the material that fiction is. And I felt that way. But I started feeling happier and better. And yoga made the difference in my life. So I started writing about it, teaching about it. And then if I could mention what was instrumental in the shift, I had been editing, Stephen Cope's a really good friend of mine, and I edited his first 3 books, I think. And then I read The Great Work of Your Life, which is about your dharma, really, and rediscovering your dharma and knowing that sometimes your dharma that felt absolutely aligned with who you were when you were in your 20s or your 30s no longer seemed aligned. And what was happening for me is that I was involved too much in the business of yoga. I was leading a training, the Life Force Yoga Practitioner training, and I loved to teach and I loved all that, but the admin was heavy on my shoulders. I wasn't writing fiction. And I read Stephen Cope's book and I said, wait a minute, it's my turn to really explore what is it that I still need to do in my life. And what, of course, arose for me was to go back to writing fiction. So I extricated myself from the admin of the training, and it now is in the hands of Rose Kress. And I went back. I didn't know if the stories were still in me. I didn't know if the characters were still in me. And in 2016, I went back to the voice of Saraswati, which had come through me in 1994 after a visit to India, and created an American frame around that voice of the temple dancer. And the American frame, the Wendy character, is so very much mirroring Saraswati's life as a temple dancer in 1938 in terms of those blessed states that yoga can bring us to, those states where we are deeply and intimately connected to self with a capital S, or to oneness, to our wholeness, to that state of the divine. And through yoga, through meditation, and I include meditation and pranayama when I speak of yoga, but that is what really drew me back to writing fiction again. And in 2004, to go back to your first question, I was on a mission to share with others what had really made such a difference in my life. So it wasn't about the perfect pose. It was the pranayama and it was the chanting. It was all those beautiful aspects of yoga that had healed me. And of course, the asana as well. We need to move the body. We are in these physical bodies. So that's sort of my whole leap from 1994 to 2020. And publishing Temple Dancer.
Well, I appreciate that. And I find it very intriguing. I didn't know that you were a fiction writer. And the idea of tackling some of the things that you're pointing to through fiction is, I think, very interesting, given everything that's been going on of late. But, before we get to your book, because I still am very curious about, you used this particular phrase right at the beginning where you said something about someone said something, you'll always have empty pockets. And it seemed to me that moment in 2004 where you want to share it with everyone, that was that's a common trajectory for a lot of us where we figured out a way to fill those empty pockets through yoga practice and got really passionate about that.
I think that's true. So many people I'll tell you a funny story, but yes, my psychiatrist was the one who said that to me. And by the way, you're one of those people who will always have empty pockets, and I will always
kind of a terrible thing to say to somebody.
Yes, it was very a blanket statement. And I did, you know, I did eventually terminate with her, even though we were, had done psychotherapy together for years. And I went to another psychiatrist, a friend psychiatrist, who saw me for a couple months. And he said, I don't see you as a candidate for that medication. And again, slowly we titrated me off that. But to speak to that common feeling that, you know, we'd take a yoga training, so many of us, because we want to deepen our own understanding, our own experience of yoga. We've been touched on the yoga mat. We've maybe shed tears on the yoga mat. And it's not about the story, but it's about a relief. And we want to understand more. And we feel better and we want to understand more. And so we go to deepen our own practice, which is what I did for the, in my initial training at Kripalu was a month long, you know, deep immersion. And I came out of there, like so many others of us, hot to teach, like to share what had made such a difference in my life with anyone else who suffered. And I think that's a pretty common feeling. We become passionate. We feel healed in some aspect of our lives. And I really believe that when we come to a yoga therapist or a yoga teacher or yoga class because we've read, you know, yoga is good for back care, or yoga is good for, you know, helps me. I might not need shoulder surgery. I can learn to you know, do something yogically that will delay or prevent my need for shoulder surgery, that kind of thing. We're mind bodies. There's always an emotional component. So being mindful of that, that emotional component. Yeah.
Well, I do think there's maybe some differences, although maybe not so much, but there's some differences for like yoga for back hair and yoga for depression. Mm-hmm. How do you think doing pranayama and asana and meditation helps address depression? Like, not everybody would know how to make a connection between those things. You know, I have those videos you mentioned of me doing this simple inhale arms up, exhale arms down. And I know for a fact people look at it like he's not even doing anything. And I'm like, that's how I healed the death of my mom and me. You know what I mean? That's like to explain how simple breathing and moving can address deep wounds is not always so easy to do. And I'm curious how you might put some words to it.
Well, we are in these bodies, and when we hurt, whether it's physically or emotionally, we constrict. In yoga, we call it the samskaras, you know, these impressions, these latent impressions, but we hold things in our physical body, our emotional body, in yogic terms, in all the koshas. So when we're constricted in our physical body, there is also an emotional constriction. And we address both the emotional and the physical. We can address it on the yoga mat in very simple ways. I know that many people, when I start a class or a workshop or a training, I'll say, how many people have cried on their yoga mat? And very rarely, you know, everybody pretty much puts their hands up. And and it's because we're not even aware of how much tension is stored in the body. So emotional tension. And when we start to release and the physical body starts feeling good, it was even something as simple as raising your arms on a breath and lowering them. When we align our mind and our body, then what we've been tamping down emotionally can bubble up. Sometimes there's a story with it, sometimes there isn't, but it's a deep release. So the pranayama, and now, I mean, when I first started, there was very little research, but now there's been a lot of research. I recently wrote a chapter in a yoga therapy book with a researcher from Germany, Helga Kramer, who has done over 160 studies. And his survey of what makes the what's the crucial aspect of healing and managing mood in terms of depression and anxiety, and it's the breathing. It's the yoga breathing, something simple that need not require even a yoga mat. Although I don't want to leave out the physical body, because we feel those constrictions in our body. So when we can combine, as you do in your beautiful videos, breath and movement together, then we have the potential to release what's constricting us. And if it's grief around the loss of your mother, it's going to move through you. It's like we're not going to protect ourselves from the barbs of life. We're not going to seal ourselves off from the betrayals and the losses. But the more we practice, the more those barbs can flow through us without sticking. We're not constricted by them. Because what we do when we practice, especially with the intent of working with the emotional body, is we're clearing away those constrictions, so that even just for a moment, if we've been diagnosed as depressed or anxious, or we have a pretty severe trauma history, when we are sensing into the body, when we're sensing into the breath, we have a window through whatever story or whatever label has been cast upon us or we've given ourselves. You know, we have that window. And as we practice more and more, that window opens wider and we stay a little longer in those states of flow. So we're not as constricted, we're not as reactive to what life brings. We can be more responsive. And I think in today's world, with all that we're going through in today's world, I really feel that being less reactive and more responsive is the key to navigating and maintaining our balance through the political situation, the climate change, the racism that we are more and more aware of, even in ourselves and in the world. We have that capacity to be responsive and not suddenly react to it. And I credit yoga for me for helping me be that kind of responsive being in the world.
Oh, I couldn't agree more with everything you're saying. I always talk about that actually in a tree pose practice, that in the moment when you fall over, can you smile or chuckle about that, so that there's a space enough in your head where you're getting to choose how you're going to respond to that moment rather than react to it.
Yes.
As a precedence for all other relationships.
It's a beautiful metaphor. Yeah.
And it does, you keep saying this word constriction too. And I think that resonates with me as well, that when I fall over and I do react, it's because in the moment I didn't have enough space. Like I didn't have enough space. I was constricted in there and that wasn't room to make a choice about it. I was in a, you know, fight or flight or like reactive state. And that's like a state of constriction.
Yes.
And the breathing and moving and the slowing down and the soothing my system is about reducing that constriction so there's room to perceive and make choice.
Yes, I fully agree with that. And to be able to, for me, I mean, at my stage of life, if every climate change and every stage of life means my practice is a little different. And for me, the first thing I need to do is, for example, is to hydrate my spine, because I'm stiff in the morning. So, and I didn't used to be. So I'm doing movements for the spine and breathing. But then the next thing I do before I do the rest of my practice is just pranayama, chanting, meditation. And you know, it's all, that part, part of my practice, more so than the asana part, even though I'm breathing while I'm practicing, but the focused pranayama and mudra and mantra practice, it just sets me, it opens me to be receptive to what life brings and to not, and again, as you've mentioned, to be in that responsive place rather than in that reactive place. And then when I do my standing poses or any of my other poses, I'm more in a flow. And that's just grown for me over, gosh, I guess, you know, I've been meditating for many, many years, but the yoga asana and pranayama part began in 91. So, you know, that's almost 30 years of, I know it began in 89. Excuse me. It's more than 30 years of practice. Yeah, well, I became a yoga.
And it's all messed up right now.
Yeah,
I mean,
right.
When I hear right. you saying this, it's interesting. I've been talking about this with a number of different people.
Mm-hmm.
Who, right now, in the midst of all this, where things are getting more concentrated and local, and nobody's traveling internationally because you can't,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That in my own personal practice, I've really felt this need to return to some things that I kind of moved away from. One in particular is chanting, in the sense because, and I was writing about this some, that there was kind of like market forces
mm-hmm.
and like trends away from certain aspects of yoga
mm-hmm.
that were more esoteric in nature. I think a lot of us believe it, like we all believe in the unicorns and rainbows, but we kept it on the down low or whatever, you know?
Yeah.
And like a lot of people at a certain time, and you mentioned it earlier, kind of went in a yoga therapy direction because we needed, I mean, I didn't because I wasn't working in the research or clinical area, you know,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
but it was an avenue to like distinguish what you were doing from just like the workout stuff.
Exactly. And it was sort of a way of validating it in a medical world and the clinical world. And I feel, you know, in your last blog post, you talked about yoga not being mainstream, and I really feel that movement away from into yoga therapy, which I love. I think it's important. I think it's valuable. It's valuable in all kinds of settings, clinically and medically. But the root of yoga is never going to be mainstream. The chanting and the prayers. And I'm not talking about Hinduism. I'm talking about the vibration of the tones that really affect our physical, emotional, spiritual, mental bodies. Those vibratory sounds make such a difference. And, you know, even from a clinical standpoint, they're healing. But to me, that's the essence of yoga is the healing potential, but that core of yoga, that spirituality, that connection to the divine, as we each in our own way know the divine, that's the portal that yoga brings us, that portal into that knowing of who we truly are, our true natures as not separate from the divine as we know the divine. And that's the essence to me and mm-hmm. to, I think, to many of us of what yoga is. And I don't think that's ever going to be mainstream.
Well, you know, I had Amy Wheeler on the show not so long ago, very recently. She was singing a similar song to you. You know,
wow.
It's not that there isn't like a value to yoga therapy, as you say, or mm-hmm. the research or people trying to bring that stuff into medicine.
Mm-hmm.
There is a point at which she was talking about sattva and this feeling of sattva, and mm-hmm. there's not necessarily a way to measure that in a, you know, quantifiable double blind placebo test or whatever.
Right, you know, right.
And I talked with Timothy McCall about the same thing,
yeah.
you know, about how it's not like it's not like a devaluing of science, but it's an acknowledgement that there's like mystical realities and magic in the universe or something.
And that sense of connection, like, you know, whether it's you and I talking and finding synchronicity in our values and what we feel, and whether it's that or whether it's our working with our students on Zoom or in person. And, you know, we just have that sense of connection that is deeper than any study, any randomized controlled trial is going to reveal. And that's where the real healing is. And, you know, you can't sort of separate, okay, this pranayama is, you know, effective for this, you know, treats this condition. It's just,
if you're trying to make it mainstream, it's a very difficult ground to stand on.
Yeah.
To say it's about prayers. When people want to know what's the chemical reaction happening, or, you know, the venous blood flow or whatever that's making you go from depressed to not depressed. And you're saying, no, it's something felt inside you and you can't put words to it.
Well, you can. I mean, you can actually say that the practice as a whole or individual practices, you know, affect the dorsal vagal system so that we're out of fight or flight. You can say that oxytocin and prolactin, those feel-good hormones, are elevated. You can say that there's more oxygen in the blood. We're oxygenating the blood. Very good for COVID right now. We're, you know, there, all of these things are documented, and there's, it's now, quote, evidence-based. But that, all I'm saying is, and that's great, but all I'm saying is, and I've participated in those studies. I'm the co-author of several of them. But what I'm saying is that yoga is so much more than that. And that is important. And yet, we just can't lose sight of the root of yoga, which is just that deepest connection to, I believe, self with a capital S. You know, that that unified sense of where we are unsullied by whatever has happened to us. We're in that state. And that's where we can achieve those states also, I believe, through art, through dance, through sacred sexuality. And that's sort of the lessons I've learned for 30 years are really underscore what temple dancer is about through character. But it's a seeker, a longtime seeker, and someone who is a dancer in another culture, who you know, her voice emerges in 1938.
Let me ask you about that, because I was going to go there and you went right there too, so it's perfect, because you said it perfectly. You said that there's a point at which the looking at it through a scientific lens can't encompass all that it is. And that these other, I often refer to them as like the contemplative aspects of the practice, or these other subtle things, this filling of the empty pockets, as we were saying. And these days, one of the things I was talking with T.S. Lil about is ways to get there. Like, it's moved away from like functional movement for me and more towards like finding more poetic language to describe things. And you said like art. And so that's why I was so intrigued by you writing in fiction, because frankly, the idea, and you just said it, like sacred sexuality, I think it's a little taboo right now because of all the scandals.
And I'm thinking about
the Me Too movement. So when it's fiction though, it's a potentially a way to communicate things without it getting so caught up in all this politics or polarization.
You make a really good point, because when I'm thinking about the the vehicle of our bodies as a way in which we are in the present moment and we are sensing into the present moment. And there have been traditionally women spiritual seekers like Mirabai, the poet who, you know, was, I think, 18th century Indian woman. And, you know, she wrote, I'm going to just read a quote from her. "Within the body are gardens, rare flowers, peacocks, the inner music. Within the body, a lake of bliss. On it, the white soul swans take their joy." And what for thousands of years, there have been women priestesses who have used their sacred sexuality as a doorway, a portal to the divine, and have found themselves in trance states. Not necessarily just, I'm not talking about the sexual act, of the sexual intimate act, but the yearning, the longing, like, for example, Rumi says, when we look for God, God is in the look of our eyes. So it's that yearning. And there are Christian mystics, like Mechtilde of Magdeburg, I think is the city. And there are so many mystics, women mystics, who've understood this. And often, as with the Devadasi in India, the temple dancers, it gets to a point where their freedom, the freedom of the temple dancers, is a threat to the traditional Eastern and Western religions. And there's a sense of, we need to control female sexuality. And despite that sense of control, women's voices have risen. And that's pretty much the theme, the core theme of Temple Dancer, the rising of women's voices through sacred sexuality. And that doesn't, it's the longing, it's the yearning to connect that's the portal in, even more so than the actual act of intercourse or, you know, sexual acts.
Yes, that's very interesting to me. So first of all, the idea of it being dance, being a practice of sacred sexuality and the power that that can hold. But even deeper to what you were saying, because in my own, I don't know, inquiry into the history of yoga philosophy or the many different threads of yoga philosophy, I've always had this idea, and it's been reinforced through lots of different sources, that there has been, maybe from an early time that we can't know exactly when, but there was a course of events where we have suppressed what I would call feminine polarity, where we have, there's not a mutuality between a male-female polarity. And I'm not talking about gender, but like in terms of energies within ourselves and then in our societies. And that's why we see what we see, I think. There's this gross dysfunction, and the dysfunction is rooted in a denial of feminine and a suppression of feminine.
Yes, and I think that's, there's been a rise and then a tamping down because there's been a fear of the strength and the power of the feminine, especially when it's backed up by the sense of connection to the divine. And that's exactly, just if I could just tell you what happened in 1947 with the temple dancers, and what this is sort of what motivated me to write about them, or about a particular temple dancer. In 1947, after 1,200 years of sacred temple dance, these women were trained in Sanskrit, they were dancers, they led rituals in the community, they tied the tali, the golden thread, around the bride's neck, they did all kinds of life cycle rituals, they were part of the religious community. And in 1947, one of the first acts of the Madras Council was to ban temple dance. And these women who had practiced their art for 1,200 years, and there was another aspect to it as well, which I can talk about, because their dances were what we know now as a sanitized version of classical Indian dance or Bharatanatyam. They had a little more sexual, sensuous movements. They were sanitized after 1947 and taught in the schools. And they hired the male dance masters to teach them through the David Dasis, the temple dancers, pretty much onto the street. And because they were auspicious women, but they were also unchaste, and that meant that when they were dedicated, they were like nuns dedicated to God. They married God, but they were also the consorts, like a geisha, of either the temple priest or the Maharaja or some wealthy landowner. So these women became very powerful because they were given gifts of cows and land and gold for this other aspect of their lives. And they were usually with just one patron. They weren't like prostitutes. But once they were thrown out, they were basically unmarriageable because they were married to God and they were unchaste. And many of them, to survive, had to become prostitutes. So it was from being sacred, auspicious members of the community, they were disgraced, humiliated, and it was just, it became for me an example of the ways in which the dominant culture seeks to tamp down what they fear, the richness and power of female sexuality. So that's sort of the story within the story, because what happens is a spiritual seeker on a pilgrimage to India in the 90s meets an elderly Devadasi on a train who's very mysterious. And when she disappears, and literally she disappears, there's what's left is a red, what looks like a diary in Karnatakan. And so Wendy, the American protagonist, takes that diary to Wesleyan University, which is the largest world music program in the country. And an emeritus professor translates it, but he dies before she receives it. And 20 years later, it shows up in her inbox because his granddaughter has found it. And that's when she goes on spiritual retreat at Yogaville, which is a spiritual home for me, to read the diary and reflect about what she was going through, which was a lot of painful divorce, a lot of it having to do with her own sexuality and expressions of that. So it mirrors the story. She's reading about Saraswati, the temple dancer, at the same time that she's really reliving some of her past and the mistakes she's made. And so they both have these parts of them that are filled with shame around their sexuality. And that was once honored and esteemed, and so that's how it connects.
It does. Go ahead.
One more thing I was just going to say is, because I've studied what I'm most drawn to study is Vedanta, Advaita Vedanta, and one of my primary teacher was at a Gurukula in India. And so there's a lot of Vedanta philosophy sort of woven in. It kind of is like the culmination of, what I'm passionate about is woven into this novel.
Well, I mean, it's very intriguing, this idea of sacred sexuality even. I think partly there's something that has to be dispelled with, because there is sort of this neo-tantra movement. Mm-hmm. Where people talk about it, mm-hmm. like when you say practice sacred sexuality, that can kind of mean a lot of different things, I guess, mm-hmm. is what I'm saying.
Yeah, I'm not really...
What does it look like what do you mean when you say practice sacred sexuality?
Yeah, fully embodied in the senses. So, and it's not so much about sex, although it can be, but it's really about being using the senses to connect to God. And even when we do a simple body scan, we're tuning into the present moment, and what's present is the fullness of oneness, whether you call it God or wholeness. That's what we're tuning into, that present moment. We're not, you know, the mind is a time traveler, but when we're feeling the sensations in our palms after doing, as you've just described earlier, lifting the arms and lowering them on the breath and doing that several times and then sensing into the palms, we are that present moment. And that's the doorway. That's the senses. That's the doorway in. And so much of religion has tamped down the senses. You know, we've got to transcend the senses. So It's not so much, I'm not speaking of Tantra so much as basically using all we've been giving these bodies for the lifetimes that we live, and to use the body as to use every aspect of our being to connect to wholeness, to something beyond what's going on in the streets of New York City or the streets of Portland, Oregon. Those are important. We need to stay present and open, but we need to connect to the source of who we are, to our wholeness. And sacred sexuality is a part of that. We can't like cut it off and deny it. It's part of it.
Well, I hear what you're saying, and I think that when I hear you saying it, it sounds just like healing to me, that like even for myself, this process, like we talked about in terms of being more responsive than, you know, being more, responsive than reactive. Mm-hmm. And this process of like going inside, it required a certain sensitivity that was constricted, as we were talking about earlier. And to ease that constriction, to feel more, is in a way this embrace of feminine in me.
Beautiful.
And a sort of surrendering over this male energy in me, which tamps it down.
Yeah. That's
and
beautiful.
It has to surrender. It has to surrender over to it.
Yeah. You know, that's so interesting to play with that, to allow that inner feminine and, you know, my inner masculine whoever you're partnered with, to allow both to flourish, to acknowledge and love all parts of ourselves. Because we're not just, you know, all male or all female. We have all of these parts. And, you know, there's a wonderful, the 2019 a Booker Prize in England was won by a Black woman, Bernadine Evaristo, I think is how you pronounce her name, for Girl, Woman, Other. And there's a character in there that speaks, that's really, I think, reflects what we're talking about. The character's name was Gopal, and they are in transition, and then they are, they're transsexual, so they become Bibi. And what the character says is that they are not taken seriously as they could feel the difference in the way they were treated, because this person, Bibi, presents as a woman, totally as a woman. So it's not that people are looking askance because they think she's transgendered or transsexual. It's that she could feel less. She even says, I think there's a line in there that she says, I'm definitely taken less seriously when I open my mouth. And I mean, I think that speaks to the dominant culture and
the core of our dysfunction in society.
Yeah, right.
I mean, yeah. It really does. I mean, I guess I don't always, it certainly does then express itself in sexuality and how you relate sexually with your partner.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I guess absolutely, I've always felt that at a certain point, my sex became a practice of my connection with partner,
mm-hmm.
just because of the sensibility that comes about over time through practice. Like, it,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I guess that's what you're saying, that if you embrace practice in a deep, full way, in the ways that you need to, I think, to fill those empty pockets and mm-hmm. become less constricted and more responsive, then it does kind of make your experience of life more ritualistic and more prayer-filled. And like we were saying earlier, and that would include your sexuality and your sex.
Yes. Yeah, all of it.
That's very tantra, you know. You said it might not be tantra, but that's total tantra right there.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, I have studied a little bit of Kashmiri Shaivism and, yeah. you know, so, and I certainly, yeah, it's the senses, it's all of it. It's sexual, but it's also, for me, I remember years and years ago, I was not partnered at the time, and I remember I was practicing yoga daily, and I remember feeling and really appreciating that union I could feel without a partner, that there was something in the way in which I practiced on my mat that was about the yearning, and that yearning really connected me to all that I sought, and I was that. I was not separate from it. And then, you know, then we begin to translate that as we become partnered and, you know, we're in relationship, which begins to also, as you mentioned, define us sexually as we, you know, the choice of a partner, but then just the way in which we're intimate begins to define us. And in that too, there is that we begin, if we can practice in a way that we sense the divinity of our partners, that we connect to their divinity, we see we see God in the eyes of our partners, then it's more of a vehicle, and it doesn't lessen who they are, it expands who they are.
Well, that really goes back to where we started about yoga can't be mainstream, because right now in the mainstream, sexuality is not what you just described, you know, and even like there's this very misguided, kind of harmful idea of sexuality, I think. And then what's interesting to me, and I'm intrigued to hear you speak to, is there's almost this idea as women get older, their sex goes away because they're not whatever looked that one way in the magazine anymore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but that's not true. I'm here to tell you.
That's what I'm saying. I'm so curious about that. So, like, as you get older, how does your sexuality come? How is that expressed for you? I guess is the only one you could speak to.
Well, it deepens, and I am partnered now, and I feel seen and acknowledged and held and. You know, in all the ways that count. And I think we probably would be remiss if we didn't mention the misuse of sex spiritually in our communities. Our almost every lineage has had the use of sex that is abusive. Usually with male teachers, you know, so that if we didn't, there has been, and often it's spoken of as, you know, this is the way, a portal to the divine, you know, to accept my semen.
A teacher up on a pedestal, and then, you know, mm-hmm. that teacher then doesn't live up to what everybody thinks they are and abuses their power and
exactly. It hurt and hurts people. So, but that's what I'm talking about coming from it is the core, and men and women have this, that sacred connection through being in a body. And I don't think, I mean, so far it hasn't changed for me. And it's part of who I am. It hasn't diminished. It's an expression of my love for my partner, my love for the divine. It's just all part of it. And so I'm going places I hadn't expected to talk about with you, Jay.
Yeah, well,
loving it.
I so appreciate that your book is about these kinds of things, but it goes back to the point I made before, very interesting to me, because it is about how do we talk about these things without falling into these traps that have been laid now when we mm-hmm. try to talk about sexuality or spirituality even. Mm-hmm. And so to have it be through fiction, but that's clearly rooted in real experience, you know, like you can see, you can't write those characters and those stories without there being life underneath them. And clearly it's coming from your life.
Yeah,
how much of your life is in the story?
Well, I think there's an emotional truth. Here's the thing about fiction. I truly believe that fiction is truer than, say, memoir or nonfiction, any form of nonfiction. The reason being is that you may create different biographies, different stories. Like the American character, Wendy, does not have, I mean, she makes mistakes, but they're not the same mistakes I made. Or I have made in my life. I've made mistakes. I have things that I regret. And of course, Wendy does as well. They're different, but the emotional truth is there. You can, because when you're writing nonfiction memoir, you're often having to either protect yourself to a certain degree or protect others who may still be alive or protect your family members who remember the people who are still alive, because you don't want to disrupt whatever system has supported you. And so you may be true, you may be speaking truth about certain things, but you're protective about other things. Whereas when you're writing fiction, there's an emotional truth. So how much of my story is in there? There's a painful part that when Wendy's visit back to India in the early 90s is to reconnect with a spiritual teacher, a guru who kicked her out essentially, and who she felt abandoned by and was in so much pain that she stopped teaching. Well, actually, she wasn't a yoga teacher. I was. That actually happened to me. Not the same story, not the same time frame, different reasons. But, I felt I had a big stick teacher, and his way of breaking through the ego was to sort of stop speaking and abandon the person. I've since been told, my dear friend Shirley Tallis and I talked about this the other day, and she said, it's not talked about so much, but sometimes when spiritual teachers feel too much of an attachment themselves, they will cut you off. So she put it in, she gave them a different light to it. But anyway, that aspect of the teacher, the disturbance, the being sent away, is in the novel, and I share that experience, although not the details of it. And then, of course, I've gone through a divorce. This was a completely different scenario, but the emotional truths, were true. And there were aspects of that story that come from my own life, but the characters, the ex-husband doesn't look anything or sound anything like my ex-husband, that kind of thing. There's a daughter, mother-daughter relationship. The daughter is so very different from my daughter, but there's still, in creating a mother-daughter situation, you can mine the material of the emotions that that and the guilt that almost I don't think I've ever met a mother that doesn't feel some guilt, like not good enough mothering. And that, you know, as much as we try. And then as children, we look at our mothers and we want to distance ourselves, perhaps, or we reject their values. So yet, you know, so those are sort of commonalities that we all share. And so parts of, yeah, my, not my story so much, but my emotional reality, my emotional journey is in the character of Wendy.
Well, I'm going to say that that is part of your story. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that's very intriguing to me because I write some, as you mentioned, but everything mm-hmm. I've written has never been, I've never written fiction. Mm-hmm. And it's mm-hmm. very intriguing to hear that idea of, I can see that, how like freeing that is in a way. Because mm-hmm. you don't have to try to, this idea of getting truth or like, and then the touchiness of how you telling your truth would affect other people that you're also writing about in your life or whatever. Mm-hmm. And to find a way to express what you need to express through characters mm-hmm. and fiction is in a way kind of what's been happening some in my practice, where instead of thinking about this, you know, triangle vinyasa that I like to do mm-hmm. as like, you know, functional movement of reaching for something on the top of the shelf. Mm-hmm. Nowadays, while I'm doing it, I'm imagining the sound of the way the wind blows through the tree when I take my walk every day.
Mm-hmm.
Like mm-hmm. finding those mm-hmm. ways to bring in that other kind of, like T.S. was saying, liminal kind of space.
Yeah.
Like you described back in our early days when we first got into it, that's what it was about for me. It was like, I was like a performance artist at the time.
Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm.
it was like a performance art to heal myself.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And we moved away from that or something in the mainstreaming and tried mm-hmm. to make it something that was more palatable to this mainstream audience. And now I'm saying, no, we got to let it be the magic.
It is. It's the magic that's real, that makes life real, that for me and for students, I think is so transformative. One of the things, I we may be running out of time, so stop me, but
we're okay. We'll keep going.
Okay. I remember standing in the line in the dining hall at Kripalu, which was a number of years ago, and there was a, you know, nice looking man behind me and asking me what I had been doing at Kripalu. And I said, I was teaching a workshop on yoga and depression. And he said, oh, are you Amy Weintraub? And I said, yes. And he said, I gave that book, Yoga for Depression, to my daughter when she was coming out of the hospital. She had been in a psychiatric hospital for depression, and I'm here because she's graduating from her yoga teacher training. So it's those moments of knowing how healing, it's not like my book healed her. It was that it inspired and motivated her to take up, to roll out a mat and to begin her own journey that led her first, you know, to practice and to become a yoga teacher, and then to become she actually took the Life Force Yoga practitioner training eventually. So
those moments are the whole reason to do it.
Absolutely.
It's the whole reason. It's what makes it worthwhile. And that's why when it gets too businessy and there's all that admin on, you can't even, all you're doing is admin.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You lose sight of those, like Nishila Devi was on and she talked about the namaste effect, where that which is between you disappears, you know? Like,
right. Mm-hmm.
That's the whole, that's the power. That's the glory.
Yeah. I think, you know, Nishila is a true teacher, and her, you know, it's not about the yoga mat for her. It's about union. It's about union with who we are inside, the divine And that is the journey of yoga. And again, as we started, that's not mainstream. I don't think it ever will be, but it is what heals us. It is that inner journey.
Yeah, more and more, I really do think it is. It's like art. Even you putting out this book, this new book, which, you know, like publishing right now is all crazy, you with the internet and everything. So you put this stuff out there, and it doesn't, it's not necessarily, I don't know, you can, maybe you think different. You make it because it comes from a soul place to make it. And you put it out there and you hope people read it. Mm-hmm. And hopefully lots of people will listen to this and go buy it. But it also, but you can't do it for that reason. That's the thing. That's with the yoga. You can't be like, okay, I'm doing this teacher training because I need that 15 people to come so I can pay my rent or whatever. Like, that's the thing. It's not that you wouldn't make money off of it, but the process of doing it has to come from that soul practice place.
Absolutely.
Get clouded.
Yeah. Well, for me, there was a dharmic duty I felt, because I really felt the voice of Saraswati coming through me in 1994. And I felt I needed to share. It was a gift. And then I researched temple dancers after the voice came through me, this young Indian girl. And I thought, you know, I'd never had an experience like that before. And I felt like I was taking dictation. And I felt that I had a duty to share it. And so I've been able to, like, do the things that you do to promote a book. Obviously, I'm not traveling and going to bookstores and things like that. But because I feel that it's Saraswati's voice, it's time that her voice be heard in the world. I've held on to it in my own heart's mind for far too long. So for me, there's also that dharmic duty to Saraswati and to her voice.
Well, I find that wonderfully courageous also, because I've often had experiences of, like, whatever, seeing colors, or mm-hmm. I wouldn't say voices, but mm-hmm. I had some experience like that, but owning those and, like, admitting to them, you know, people think you're kind of crazy, but I don't think that's crazy. And the idea that the way that you described it is, like, you heard this voice from, mm-hmm. does that come from without you or from within you? Or have you contemplated that? Like, where does those voices come from? Are those other entities in?
I haven't really questioned it, Jay, because it just was
probably best not to. Yeah. See, I'm messing it up. My analytical mind's about to screw up the whole thing.
No, you know, it was a flow, and nothing before or since that I've written has come to me that way or arisen that way. And I actually, in the author's note, I talk about some mystical experiences I had on that trip in 94 to India that, you know, I didn't realize at the time were mystical. They were more emotional and connected to temple dancers that I didn't even realize, because I didn't know what a temple dancer was. And then when I came back to New England after that trip, that voice just began to flow through me. And I was just like lighting. And that part, I mean, other than adding some ritual and things from my research, that voice has not changed. I rewrite and I revise it over and over and over again. But that voice has been pure. That voice has not changed of that. She starts as an 8-year-old, and the novel ends when she's about 18. So for those 10 years of her life, that voice just flowed through me in about 3 months.
Wow. See, isn't that interesting? I know that from a writing experience too, that a lot of times the blog write, it's written before I go down to write it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then it's just a matter of getting it down.
Mm-hmm.
I know there's other writers who have different process, but I could see that, like, that story's been brewing in you for a long time, and then just 3 months to get it down, right?
Yeah. You know, it might have even been less, because I was staying with my parents in Longboat Key, Florida, actually, when most of the voice came through, and I don't think I was there for 3 months.
Well, there you go. Well,
it was like a download, you know.
Yeah, I get it. And just that's when it comes right out, and that's when I think stuff seems to me to have the most impact when it comes from that kind of place. So
yeah.
Very cool, Amy. Well, are you teaching these days? I mean, I guess we're all at home. I'm sure you're doing some online stuff, but
yeah, workshops. I have a Yogaville workshop coming up this weekend. I don't know when this podcast airs, but I'm also in a couple of trainings. I teach modules in the inner peace training on yoga, life force yoga, and mood management, depression, anxiety. So I'm doing trainings mostly that are on Zoom, not regular yoga classes. Although as we moved into the pandemic, I did a whole free YouTube series called Remote Relief, and they're short practices that are just taking us through with mudras, mantras, pranayamas, that sort of thing, not asanas so much. A little bit of movement, but not a lot. And those are on my YouTube channel. But I stopped doing that because I realized that my yoga colleagues were trying to make a living. And if by offering these free practices, it might be cutting into people who might want to go to a class and sign up, subscribe to a series of classes, like your beautiful classes. So I did that for a couple months, and I said, no, I think it's time to not do those remote relief practices anymore. They're like 2 to 15 minutes, and they're,
I appreciate that. I think a lot of folks had that impulse when everything got shut down. They wanted to just help and give back, but
exactly.
It's nice of you to have that consideration because there is such upheaval in the industry. And although, like I said, maybe we stop thinking of it as an industry, but there is a value to classes and teachers. And so I appreciate that sentiment a lot. Mm. Well, I hope at some point though, we are going to get back in the same room again. People, because my daughters are doing school on the Zoom and it's not great. I mean, it's okay, but there's something that happens when you're in the same room. It's just non-spoken. And I look forward to a time when we'll be able to come together again in person.
Oh, I do too. I do too. There's nothing like that transmission, that connection, that heart to heart eye contact. So yeah, I agree with you. And I hope we'll be in the same room
together. Yes, I was going to say, I want to give you a hug. It's great to have a chance to connect with you like this, Amy. It really has been a wonderful conversation. Thank you so much. I will be in touch with you about everything, okay?
Okay. I look forward to hearing further from you. And namaste.
Yeah, take namaste. Care.
You too.
And there you go. Sacred sexuality through a narrative of the temple dancer. I'm digging it. I got a copy. She sent me one after we spoke, and my wife picked it up first. She's reading it now. I'm going to read it after her. There will be a link in the description. You can get yourself a copy. And it was just great to connect with Amy. I've really been thinking about what she said in regards to fiction sometimes being truer than nonfiction. And that's really just led to a whole inquiry. I was talking with the teachers in the teacher's class this week about what is truth? Is there such a thing as truth? And how do we know it's true? Man, we went deep. We went real deep. And it was a little bit of a springboard off of this conversation that I had with Amy. Really grateful to have had this chance to speak with her. Thanks so much, Amy. And, she was communing with me on the beginning about two things, about the mortgage and whether or not yoga is mainstream. And that's the other thing I had an update about, because I got like a little bit of word about the mortgage, but not like the end word. It doesn't look great, though, I have to say. Like, the initial assessment was, like, not approved because of the government assistance, because the government actually changed the guidelines that the underwriters are following when it comes to the PPP loans and the PUA assistance, and nobody knows what to do with it. So it has to go to a head underwriter, and the head underwriter has to grant an exception because I didn't make it through the initial automated thing that they plug it into. I understand, I learned that like something like over 80% of all mortgage loans are done in an automated system. They just plug stuff in and then it says, okay, but there's no actual humanity to it. So I actually need a human to take a moment to look at it. And if they do, then it seems like anytime someone who's human actually looks at what I'm doing, then they're like, oh yeah, okay, this guy seems like a good risk or whatever. And but if I don't get that human person to consider my situation, then I don't make any sense on paper. And that's the other thing that she was saying, that she didn't think that yoga's mainstream, and it really been proven true to me. It's not a mainstream thing that we're doing, being yoga teachers. It's not. And that's okay. I've come to grips with that. I think that's fine. It's just the way that we're going to think about it that's the difference, you know? So, in any case, I still have a chance. I still have a chance to see if my guy can get me this exception. But I'm not holding my breath, let's just say that. And, you know, I've got some other ideas about things I'll try. But the big takeaway for me is this clear idea about where I stand. And that's important, just to know where I stand. And that's not an easy thing to do these days. It's hard to know where to stand with all the swirl of global events and politics. And like I mentioned in the intro, Sean Korn's going to be here next week. We're going to talk about QAnon and the election, and we're going to really get into it. But it's with Sean Korn, and Sean's great, and we easily connect, and we got deep into it. And I'm really glad that we did, and that you'll hear that next week if you tune in. Otherwise, I don't know. I feel rambly this week. I hope that's okay. It's a rambly week. Just feels like getting thrown with the waves, you know? Just trying to keep my sense of the North Star. I'm straining metaphors here, y'all. That's an indication that it's time to go. I really hope that you're doing okay, that you're keeping a little bit of a sense of humor to yourself about it all, because the shit storm's coming, like I said, and it's probably going to be good for us to be prepared on some level, you know, that we're just going to have to roll with it, you know? We're going to have to roll with it, hope for the best, and do whatever we can to be a force of good in the universe, whatever that means to you. All right, at the very least, let's be kind, okay? Let's be kind to ourselves. Let's be kind to others. And I will talk to you again soon. Please take care. Cheers.